Campfire stories are probably something that we're all familiar with. Even if you've never had the privilege of sitting by a campfire and swapping spooky stories, you've probably heard some of their effects. Things like the hook-handed man, or legends like Bigfoot, or other stories of things going wrong in the American wilderness. These stories, traded by frontiersmen around campfire, would result in the tall tales we know today. And while characters from these tales, like Paul Bunyan, are most common and most remembered, today, I want to talk about the monsters from these stories. And that's where we get to the fearsome critters. Hello, everybody. Today, we are going to be talking about the monsters of American mythos with the fearsome critters. Now, the term fearsome critters itself is kind of a broad term meant to encapsulate all of the different creatures and animals that were traded in these stories. Several of them have worked their way into modern culture pretty easily. Things like the snipe are well known in phrases like a snipe hunt, or creatures like the hodag get talked about pretty often, but unless you have read these books, I promise I'm going to tell you about some weird ones that you've never heard of. Like the weird axe-shaped dog that can't stop eating axe handles, or the thing that looks like a coffin that whenever it walks off a mountain, it explodes. That's all it does. It looks like a coffin and then it blows up. The majority of these fearsome critters were entirely oral tradition until the early 1900s. It was then that a few people decided to chronicle these tales, lest they be lost forever. And while there were several people who did this, I want to look at two of the earliest and most remembered copies that we have today. And that is Fearsome Creatures of the Lumberwoods by William T. Cox and Fearsome Critters by Henry Tryon. Now, that being said, there are several other resources for the fearsome critters as well. There's Yarns of the Big Woods, which is basically a compilation of a bunch of these creatures that made their way into newspaper articles at the time, and a ton of other resources to read about these. There is actually a really cool website called lumberwoods.org that has an entire library of all the big hitters from this category that I'll have linked in the description. So if you want to read these two books or any other ones, feel free to check them out. It's really cool stuff. For those who've been keeping up with the Cryptid Iceberg series, you'll know that every time I come across one of these guys, I freak out because it is my favorite part about trading stories. I think they're so cool and interesting, and today I just get to talk about them. So I'm excited, and hopefully you are as well. Also, I was really going to match the lumberjack, you know, Northwoods vibe and record this outside, but it is hot and also loud, and I also don't know how to work my camera when it's that bright out, and also I'm lazy, so you have this fake pretend one. But really, I'm not even here right now. I am at my house sending a recording to you so your brain can trick you into thinking I am in the room with you right now as I talk about this. Isn't that strange? But yeah, this is all you people get. Deal with it. We're getting into October. It's the start of the spooky season, so I figure what better way to begin than with a few campfire stories. So if any of that sounds interesting to you, then stick around as we talk about the fearsome critters of the Lumberwoods. Right after the ad, which the ad actually hasn't got here yet, so I'm kind of just oh, there it is now. I should probably change into uniform. Oh. It's you. Of course it's you. It's been a few minutes, huh? Yeah. You know, I saw you in the grocery store the other day. Actually, I didn't say anything. I knew you didn't see me. And sometimes, you know, I don't even know what I blame. Because I don't blame myself. I think I'm too stubborn for that. And I certainly don't blame you. So maybe it was just something that was supposed to happen, I guess. You know, had I not tried to do it myself, tried to do everything my own way, like I always do, this house ain't been a home without you. And I'm tired of trying to make it one, to be honest. So what do you say? You forget everything that was. You and me, let's try this again. I'd like that. So yeah, Magic Spoon. That's right, everyone, I have relapsed. But it's for the better, because this is Magic Spoon we're talking about. That's because each box of Magic Spoon contains 13 to 14 grams of protein, 0 grams of sugar, and 4 to 5 grams of net carbs per serving. And on top of that, their treat bars have 11 to 12 grams of protein, only 1 gram of sugar, and 1 to 2 grams of net carbs per serving. per serving. Not only that, but as you can see, they look and taste delicious as well. I remember when I was a kid, I used to eat cereal bars all the time, but my mom made me stop because, you know, they were unhealthy. But now, my mom has to grow up. On top of that, what is there to say about Magic Spoon cereal that I haven't said already? I'm obsessed with it. You know that. I know that. My therapist knows that. Not only is Magic Spoon healthy and delicious, but what I really like about it is that it lets me relive the nostalgia of being a child and eating cereal on the couch without, you know, the whole crushing reality that I'm gonna die one day or something. And thanks to the new flavors they keep adding and things like the Treat Bar, Magic Spoon can fit any kind of lifestyle, from sitting down and eating breakfast to being on the go.
And on top of that, Magic Spoon is also available on Amazon and in retail stores.
I'm aware Magic Spoon has become a bit of a meme on the channel because of how much I talk about it and how much I like it, and I say good, I've been called worse. So if you want to figure out what my obsession's about and get obsessed with it today, then right now, there's never been a better time to get in on this offer. That's because right now, if you head to my link in the description at magicspoon.com/Wendigoon or use discount code Wendigoon or scan the QR code, you'll be able to get your Magic Spoon order for $5 off. That is right, $5 off. Whatever combination you go with, some of my personal favorites are the cinnamon roll, the birthday cake, the strawberry shortcake, although you really can't go wrong with any of them. And as far as the bars go, I am partial to the marshmallow flavor myself. So again, to get all of this for $5 off your order, either use my link in the description at magicspoon.com/Wendigoon or discount code Wendigoon or scan the QR code to get in on this incredible offer today. Thank you all so much for watching the ad, and as always, thank you so much to Magic Spoon for sponsoring the video. It really does mean the most. Hope you all check them out. Link is in the description, and we are back to the video. We are going to go ahead and get into it, but as always, thank you for watching. So the Fearsome Critters is something that's kind of hard to pin down. Again, most of this was just stories traded around a campfire, so it's hard to tell which versions of the creature are mainstream and which ones are just offshoots told in a couple stories. And between different accounts, even these two books, there's a lot of overlap. Like, each book will cover the same Fearsome Critter, but their stories and details about it will be different. So because the purpose of this video is to give you the base idea of each of these creatures, and then you can make your own stories or decisions about them, I am going to default to whatever the oldest version of the tale is. For example, Cox covered the Hoogag in his 1910 edition, and Treon also covered it in his 1930s edition. So when we get to the Hoogag, I'm going to go with what Cox said. Again, giving you the earliest version of each creature, and then you can make up whatever stories you want from there. Because as we're going to go over, one of the coolest parts about these guys is you can pretty much say whatever you want about them. So with all that clarification out of the way, let's get to the actual monsters, beginning with the Hoogag.
The Hoogag is a huge animal of the Lake States. Its range includes western Wisconsin, northern Minnesota, and a territory extending indefinitely northward in the Canadian wilds towards Hudson Bay. In size, the Hoogag may be compared to the moose, and in form, it somewhat resembles that animal. Very noticeable, however, are its jointless legs, which compel the animal to remain on its feet, and its long upper lip, which prevents it from grazing. If it tried that method of feeding, it would simply tramp its upper lip into the dirt. Its head and neck are leathery and hairless. Its strangely corrugated ears flop downward. Its four-toed feet, long bushy tail, shaggy coat, and general makeup give the beast an unmistakably prehistoric appearance. The Hoogag has a perfect mania for traveling, and few hunters who have taken up its trail ever came up with the beast or back to camp. It is reported to keep going all day long, browsing on twigs, flopping its lip around trees, and stripping bark as occasion offers, and at night, since it cannot lie down, it leans against a tree, bracing its hind legs and marking time with its front ones. The most successful Hoogag hunters have adopted the practice of notching trees so that they are almost ready to fall, and when the Hoogag leans up against one, both the tree and the animal come down. In its helpless condition, it is then easily dispatched. The last one killed, so far as known, was on Turtle River, northern Minnesota, where a young one, weighing 1,800 pounds, was found stuck in the mud. It was knocked in the head by Mike Flynn of Cass Lake.
Immediately, you can probably see why these Fearsome Critter stories are so appealing. if you were a lumberjack in the northern woods of the United States, for one, life was rough. Not only was the risk of death monumental because, you know, your whole job is knocking down giant trees all day, but it is grueling work to do in the harsh climate with barely any of the technology we have today. So as you can imagine, life could get pretty depressing. So a lot of these guys would sit around and make the woods not depressing. Anyone who's walked through a forest can tell you, every now and then you'll see a tree that's bent over for seemingly no reason. But what if all of a sudden you give it reason and that reason becomes interesting? What if there's a creature out there that's as tall as a moose with no knees? What if it's unable to bend down to the ground so it has to strip the bark off of trees? I mean, especially in the time period, you know, late 1800s, early 1900s, these stories were being passed around. It's not like they had the internet to tell them what exactly existed in the woods they were working in. So creatures like this, sure, at the edge of reality, could very well exist. Especially if two guys at camp who are more experienced than you are telling you that it exists. Especially with the lifestyle a lot of these people had to live in, again, especially the lumberjack, why not make the terror you feel and the terror others likely feel a little more special? Henry Trion, in his opening preface to his compilation of stories, says this very thing when he says, "It is by no means unlikely that a number of these tales received their initial impetus through a woodsman being startled by some odd noise or perhaps by sighting some queer shape while traveling after sundown. Such an experience, we've all had them, is a rule quickly followed by a feeling of relief coupled with gratitude that our temporary panic had no witnesses." And the rest of the trip back to camp has often been employed in weaving the whole incident to a carefully embroidered tale to be tested out at the first opportunity. These stories meant something to the people that told them. It made the things they go through just a bit more important. So with that in mind, I want to move on to another weird creature. Because up next, we've got the Gumbaroo.
In the foggy region along the Pacific coast from Grays Harbor to Humboldt Bay, there ranges a kind of creature that has caused much annoyance in the lumberwoods. This is the Gumbaroo, which, luckily, is so rare that only once in a great while is one seen. It is believed to remain in hiding most of the time in the base of enormous, burned-out cedar trees, from where it sallies forth occasionally on frightful marauding expeditions. During these periods of activity, the beast is always hungry and devours anything it can find that looks like food. A whole horse may be eaten at one sitting, distending the Gumbaroo out at all proportions, but failing to appease its hunger or cause it the slightest discomfort. The specimens seen are reported to have been coal black, but that may have been due to their being smirched with the charred wood. In size, the beast corresponds closely to a black bear, for which it might be mistaken only for the fact that the Gumbaroo is almost hairless. To be sure, it has prominent eyebrows and some long, bristly hairs on its chin, but the body is smooth, tough, and shiny, and bears not even a wrinkle. The animal is a tireless traveler when looking for food, but is not swift in its movements or annoyed in the slightest degree by the presence of enemies. The latter characteristic is easily accounted for by the fact that no other animal within its range has ever found a successful method of attacking a Gumbaroo or a vulnerable spot in one's anatomy. Whatever strikes the beast bounds off with the same force. Its elastic hide hurls back with equal ease the charging elk and the wrathy hornet. A rock or peavey thrown at the creature bounds back at whoever threw it, and a bullet shot against its hide is sure to strike the hunter between the eyes. It is believed that the scarcity of Gumbaroos is due to their combustible character and the prevalence of forest fires. The animal burns, like celluloid, with explosive force. Frequently, during and after a forest fire in the heavy cedar near Coos Bay, woodmen have insisted that they heard loud reports quite unlike the sound of falling trees, and detected the smell of burning rubber in the air.
So you have a giant bear with a man's face that you can't kill and it also explodes. It's a combination of a lot of different things that the lumberjack is probably familiar with, mixed with stuff that he has absolutely never heard of before. But again, these stories work because they would be delivered by people who seemingly knew exactly what they were talking about. As a matter of fact, in Trion's preface again, he talks about a story where he heard one of these tall tales first mentioned. When describing how he was walking back from a job with a guy who was new to it as well as two old-timers, he says this. This lad opened the way by remarking that on the trail back to camp that afternoon, he heard an extraordinary screech-like cry which he could not identify. Given this opening, the team play developed between the two older men was simply marvelous. "How did it go?" inquired Sam, full of seeming fatherly interest. "Oh, I don't think I could imitate it," replied the lad. A moment's pause. "Reckon it was one of them tree squeaks?" put in Walter at the precise psychological moment. "They're common hereabouts in July." "What's a tree squeak like?" asked the victim, deliberately putting his foot in the trap. "Wah," drawled Sam, and the game was on. It was like watching two highly skilled bridge players. Sam would lead with a colorful bit of description, and Walter would follow suit with an arresting spot of personal experience, every detail being set forth with the utmost solemnity, and with exactly the correct degree of emphasis. At the end, so deftly had the cards been played that the listener was completely convinced of the animal's existence. This method of presentation is widely used. For the best results, two narrators who can keep the ball in the air are necessary, and perhaps an occasional general question is tossed to someone in the audience, such inquiries being invariably accorded a grave, corroborative nod. And yes, these stories were absolutely used as a form of hazing to scare the pants off of someone who just got there. Or in other cases, as we're going to see come up, send them on a quest that they can never hope to complete. But again, it makes the life just a bit more fascinating. And if you want to see a really fascinating example, well, the next up we've got the Roperite.
In the foothills of the Sierras, where the digger pine grows, dwells one of the most peculiarly specialized animals to be found anywhere on the American continent. No one knows its life history, even approximately, and many a discussion has been based upon the question as to whether the beast is born, hatched from eggs, or comes into existence spontaneously from some mountain cavern. The Digger Indians say that Roperites are the spirits of early Spanish ranchers, and blood-curdling are the tales they tell of hapless creatures pursued by the beast, snared with its marvelous rope-like beak, and dragged to death through thorny chaparral. No man or animal can hope to outrun it. It steps upon roadrunners or kicks them out of the way, and no obstacle appears sufficient to stop its progress or even slacken its speed as it seemingly half flies, half bounds across the rugged country which it inhabits. Its leathery skin is impervious to thorn, and its flipper legs uninjured by the sharpest rocks. According to A.B. Patterson of Hot Springs, California, who saw the last Roperite authentically reported, the animal has a large set of rattles on its tail, which it vibrates when in pursuit of game, thus producing a whirring sound like that of a giant rattler. The effect of this upon an animal closely pursued may be imagined. Lumbermen operating in the region between Pitt River and the southern end of the Sierras are urgently requested to make every effort to secure a living specimen of the Roperite.
There's really like three main categories of fearsome critters. There's weird hybrid impossible animals like the Roperite. And then there's stuff that explains things that happen in the woods. Something like the Hoogag, for example. And then there's other ones that just kill you. It's like they're either whimsical or they make you afraid of something or they explain something. That's typically one of the categories these stories will fall into. For an example of one that will just outright kill you, we have the Snollygoster.
In the cypress swamps of the South, and particularly in the region about Lake Okeechobee, Florida, woodmen tell of a strange and dangerous animal known as the Snollygoster. This creature is of enormous proportions and is credited with a voracious appetite. Worst of all, its appetite is only appeased by the eating of human beings. In form, the Snollygoster resembles a huge crocodile, but it is covered with long, glossy fur and has no legs or fins except one long spike on its back. A person naturally wonders how such an animal can manage to travel through the water and mud of the swamp region where it lives, but nature has provided it with a means for driving itself along. On the end of its tail are three bony plates, much resembling the propeller on a steamboat. These revolve at a terrific rate, driving the animal like a torpedo boat through the mud. They serve other purposes as well. For when a Snollygoster catches an unfortunate child, or even a full-grown adult, upon which it delights to feed, it tosses the victim up and backward so as to impale him upon the spike fin, where several may be carried until sufficient for a meal have been collected. The Snollygoster's tail is then driven into the mud and revolved until a hole is scooped out and the victims scraped off the spike and tossed in, whereupon the Snollygoster beats them into a batter with its rapidly revolving propeller and inhales them. Mr. Inman F. Eldridge of Defuniak Springs, Florida, while hunting for an outlaw in the swamps, had a most unusual experience. He caught sight of the outlaw, dead and impaled upon what at first appeared to be a slender cypress knee, but which presently began to move away. It was then seen to be the spike of a Snollygoster's back. Eldridge's first impulse was to shoot the strange beast, but upon second thought, he concluded that it was doing a good work and was entitled to live on. The very report of such a creature inhabiting the swamps would deter evildoers from venturing into these wild places to avoid their pursuers and escape justice.
For one, this creature is absolutely terrifying. A giant snake thing that churns you up in basically a blender because it has a propeller tail and then drinks up the soup. That's awesome. I love it. But this one's kind of a hybrid of the two I talked about earlier. It's an animal with technological parts on it, like a propeller tail, but it also is, again, a thing that makes you afraid of venturing too far into the swamp. I guess a sort of fourth category or half category is things that are just carried over from other traditions. For example, a lot of the lumberjacks or people that worked in the mountains of the northern United States were people who were immigrated over from regions like Ireland or the UK. So because of that, some of their legends were directly transported over to our campfires, one of those being the leprechaun.
During the early days of Upper Canada, before it became the province of Ontario, there were brought into a logging camp on the Madawaska River several young leprechauns from the north of Ireland. This animal was even then rare and has since become extinct in its native land. It is said that during the last famine, hungry Irishmen killed and ate the few remaining specimens of this queer beast. On its native bogs, the leprechaun was a harmless creature, celebrated for its playfulness and laughable antics. It would hop across the bogs, turn somersaults, and leap over hillocks with wondrous agility. A favorite trick was to bore into a pile of drying peat and then, with a sudden spring, send the clods of peat high in the air till the commotion looked like a young cyclone. These antics were all right enough in Ireland, but when the animal was brought to Canada, its disposition changed at once. The pets on the Madawaska escaped into nearby tamarack swamps, increasing and spreading until an occasional one was seen on the upper Ottawa and even over in northern Michigan. Sneaking through the tamarack and cedar, or leaping across the muskegs after whatever appealed to it as food, the leprechaun became a creature to be feared and avoided. Teamsters toting supplies across the swamp roads have been attacked by the animal, which would bound clear over the load, snapping its teeth at the driver and reaching for him with its villainous claws. Hasty flight to thick timber, leaving the team to its fate, was the only choice of the driver, who thanked his stars that, in running through tangled tamarack, even the leprechaun is no match for a frightened man.
What I find so interesting about it is, yeah, the leprechaun has some, like, negative legends in, like, original Irish folktale and stuff like that. But here it's expressly evil, right? Like, it waits at night for people that are transporting either a carriage or supplies. Then it cuts the rope so the driver leaves, and whatever he's carrying is left abandoned for the leprechaun to take. So it's implied as, like, a thief and a violent creature. Whereas, explicitly, the leprechaun isn't known as that. Again, it is another legend that is adapted into the harsh woodlands of the northern United States. And now for a complete turn of pace, let's talk about the exploding coffins with the Funeral Mountain Terrashot.
This animal explains the origin of the name of the Funeral Range, California. The creature has a casket-like body, 6 to 8 feet long, with a shell running the whole length of its back. Its four legs are long and wobbly, causing the Terrashot to sway uncertainly from side to side and forward and backward as it travels along. The strange beast was first reported by some Mormon immigrants, who observed a peculiar procession entering the desert from a certain mountain range, afterward named the Funeral Mountains. They also witnessed the tragic fate of the creatures. One of the Mormons, aroused by his curiosity, made an investigation which resulted in finding out about all that is known of the Terrashot. It seems that the animal lives in the little meadows and parks in the higher portions of the range, where it gradually increases in numbers, until, by a strange impulse, it is seized by a desire to immigrate. They then form long processions and march down into the desert with the evident intention of crossing to other ranges that can be seen in the distance. But none of them ever get across. As they encounter the hot sands, they rapidly distend with the heat, and one after another, they blow up with resounding reports, leaving deep, grave-shaped holes in the sand.
So this does a couple of things. For one, it's very weird and funny. I can only imagine how many people were convinced that there is a coffin creature that explodes randomly. But what's also interesting about them is I think this is one of those creatures that explains a couple of things. For one, Funeral Mountain is a location out west that there are a bunch of different legends and myths around. So this works as a kind of lighthearted example to why the mountain was named that. Or I should say the entire Funeral Mountain range. But I think it also explains something else that is kind of a dark reality that happened out west a lot, especially at this time, and that's grave robbing. People died a lot out west, and people had to be buried quite a bit. And it wasn't uncommon for someone looking to profit off that to dig up a grave. Well, that last mention of the Funeral Mountain terror shot leaving a grave-shaped hole whenever it blows up gives a much more lighthearted explanation to a harsh reality. Then the Funeral Mountain terror shot goes from something that's kind of strange into something comforting. Especially if someone in the group is younger and wants to know what the holes mean, you can simply tell them it's the work of this fearsome critter. After that, we've got one of my favorite ones, the Slide Rock Bolter.
In the mountains of Colorado, where in summer the woods are becoming infested with tourists, much uneasiness has been caused by the presence of the Slide Rock Bolter. This frightful animal lives only in the steepest mountain country, where the slopes are greater than 45 degrees. It has an immense head, small eyes, and a mouth somewhat on the order of a sculpin, running back beyond its ears. The tail consists of a divided flipper with enormous grab hooks, which it fastens over the crest of the mountain or ridge, often remaining there motionless for days at a time, watching the gulch for tourists or any other hapless creature that may enter it. At the right moment, after sighting a tourist, it will lift its tail, thus loosening its hold on the mountain, and with its small eyes riveted on the poor unfortunate and drooling thin skid grease from the corners of its mouth, which greatly accelerates its speed, the bolter comes down like a toboggan, scooping in its victim as it goes, its own impetus carrying it up the next slope, where it again slaps its tail over the ridge and waits. Whole parties of tourists are reported to have been gulped at one swoop by the Slide Rock Bolter, and guides are becoming cautious about taking parties far back into the hills. The animal is a menace, not only to tourists, but to the woods as well. Many a drawn-through spruce-covered slopes have been laid low, the trees being knocked out by the roots or mowed off by a scythe where the bolter has crashed down through from the peaks above. A forest ranger, whose district includes the rough country between Ophir Peaks and the Lizard Head, conceived the bold idea of decoying a Slide Rock Bolter to its own destruction. A dummy tourist was rigged up with plaid Norfolk jacket, knee breeches, and a guidebook to Colorado. It was then filled full of giant powder and fulminate caps and posted in a conspicuous place where, sure enough, the next day it attracted the attention of a bolter, which had been hanging for days on the slope of Lizard Head. The resulting explosion flattened half the buildings in Rico, which were never rebuilt, and the surrounding hills fattened flocks of buzzards the rest of the summer.
Okay, the Slide Rock Bolter is absolutely insane, and I love him so much. Like, just the idea that you can be just walking in the woods and a whale flies down a mountain at you, that is absolutely nuts and terrifying. It's great. And the whole story about them setting up a decoy to blow it up, I mean, you can already see how narratives were created out of this. Someone goes out of camp and then never comes back. You can say the bolter got him. Not to mention, this is another explanation, because things like landslides or rock faces falling off mountains were not uncommon. So if you come to a place in the woods that has all the trees wiped out down the side of a ridge, you can say it was the bolter. Another fascinating story that both explains and terrifies. Speaking of things that are explanations to stuff that is encountered in the woods, we have the Tote Road Shagamaw.
From the Wrangley Lakes to the Allegash and across in New Brunswick, loggers tell of an animal which has puzzled many a man, even those who were not strangers in the woods. Frequently, the report is circulated that the tracks of a bear have been seen near camp, but a little later, This is denied, and moose tracks are reported instead. Heated arguments among the men, sometimes resulting in fist fights, are likely to follow. It is rightly considered an insult to a woodsman to accuse him of not being able to distinguish the tracks of either of these animals. To only a few of the old timber cruisers and rivermen is the explanation of these changing tracks known. Gus Demo of Old Town, Maine, who has hunted and trapped and logged in the Maine woods for 40 years, once came upon what he recognized as the tracks of a moose. After following it for about 80 rods, it changed abruptly into unmistakable bear tracks. Another 80 rods and it changed to moose tracks again. It was soon observed by Mr. Demo that these changes took place precisely every quarter of a mile, and furthermore, that whatever was making the tracks always followed a tote road or a blaze line through the woods. Coming up within sight of the animal, Gus saw that it had front feet like a bear's and hind feet like those of a moose, and that it was pacing carefully, taking exactly a yard at a step. Suddenly it stopped, looked all about, and swung as on a pivot. Then, inverting itself and walking on its front feet only, it resumed its pacing. Mr. Demo was only an instant in recognizing by the witness trees that the place where the animal changed was a section corner. From this fact, he reasoned that the Shagamaw must have been originally a very imitative animal, which, from watching surveyors, timber cruisers, and trappers patiently following lines through the woods, contracted the habit itself. He figures that the Shagamaw can count only as high as 440. Therefore, it must invert itself every quarter of a mile.
I can't tell you how many times I've been in the woods and come across a series of animal tracks that seemingly start and end without reason. Like, you know what probably happened is the animal stepped sideways and out of the direct line, and wherever their foot came down, it didn't hold the impression as long, or something like that. But there's just enough room for imagination in your mind that maybe something strange occurred, maybe something supernatural happened, and that's where the Shagamaw likes to fit. It carries a series of different animals' footprints to stamp out, and it mimics the paths humans follow. So the next time you see deer tracks on a hiking trail, maybe it was a Shagamaw. And that makes the world just a bit more fun to look at. Speaking of things that make the world a bit more fun, we have the Wapalusi.
In the damp forest of the Pacific coast and eastward as far as the St. Joe River in North Idaho, ranges a quaint little beast, known among loggers as the Wapalusi. It is about the size of a sausage dog, but is not even distantly related to the canine family. The Wapalusi, according to lumberjacks, lives upon shelf fungus, or conches exclusively, and he is able to get them with ease no matter if they are growing on the tip-top of a 100-foot dead tree. It is a pleasure for one of these animals to climb, for he has feet and toes like those of a woodpecker, and he humps himself along like a measuring worm. Even his tail is spiked at the tip and aids him as he mounts the lofty firs in quest of food. One of the most peculiar features of the animal was discovered only recently. A lumberjack in one of the camps of the Hump Tulips River, Washington, shot a Wapalusi, and upon examining its velvety coat, decided that it would make an attractive and serviceable pair of mittens, which he proceeded to make. The hide was tanned thoroughly, and the mittens made with care, fur side out, and as the lumberjack went to work, he exhibited them with pride. Imagine his surprise upon taking hold of an axe to find that the mittens immediately worked their way up and off the handle. It was the same with whatever he took hold of, and finding that he could not use the mittens, they were left in a skid road, and were last seen working their way over logs and litters across the slashing.
So this one finds itself in the area of like the Paul Bunyan stories. Like, there's an animal that did this special thing, and then either even after death or just by its effect, other strange things happen. The idea that if you make a Wapalusi set of gloves, it just climbs whatever wooden thing you touch it to, that's adorable. It's almost like a Dr. Seuss kind of creature. Even in the illustration, it kind of looks like that. You can imagine how this would work its way into stories. Maybe two men are having a competition as to who can climb a tree, and one of them sabotages the other by giving him Wapalusi gloves, causing him to run to the top of the tree really quick and get stuck. Again, these creatures are the inception for a lot of storytelling. And speaking of, we have the cactus cat.
How many people have heard of the cactus cat? Thousands of people spend their winters in the Great Southwest, the land of desert and mountain, fruitful valleys, flat-topped means, Pueblos, Navajos, and Apaches, of sunshine and the ruins of ancient cliff dwellers. It is doubtful, however, if one in 100 of these people ever heard of a cactus cat, to say nothing of seeing one sporting about among the Chola and Palo Verde. Only the old-timers know of the beast and its queer habits. The cactus cat, as its name signifies, lives in the great cactus districts and is particularly abundant between Prescott and Tucson. It has been reported also from the valley of the lower Yaqui in Old Mexico and the Chola-covered hills of Yucatan. The cactus cat has thorny hair, the thorns being especially long and rigid on its ears. Its tail is branched, and upon the forearms above its front feet are sharp, knife-like blades of bone. With these blades, it slashes the base of giant cactus trees, causing the sap to exude. This is done systematically, many trees being slashed in the course of several nights as the cat makes a big circuit. By the time it is back to the place of beginning, the sap of the first cactus has fermented into a kind of mescal, sweet and very intoxicating. This is greedily lapped up by the thirsty beast, which soon becomes fiddling drunk and goes waltzing off in the moonlight, rasping its bony forearms across each other and screaming with delight.
This one's just funny. It's like a weird cat that gets drunk off of cactus juice. I guess you could say it's an explanation for stuff if finding, like, bled cactuses in the desert's common. I don't know if it is or not. Maybe if it is, you could say this is where that comes from. But I just think it's cute. It's a cat that gets drunk. After that, we have an especially famous one, the Hodag.
This animal has been variously described by woodsmen from Wisconsin and Minnesota. Opinions differ greatly as to the appearance of the beast, some claiming it to be covered with horns and spines and having a maniacal disposition. The description which seems most authentic and from which the sketch of the animal has been made is as follows. Size, about that of a rhinoceros and somewhat resembling that animal in general makeup. The creature is slow in motion, deliberate, and, unlike the rhinoceros, very intelligent. Its hairless body is mottled, striped, and checked in a striking manner, suggestive of the origin of the patterns upon Mackinaw clothing, now used in the lumberwoods. On the Hodag's nose, instead of a horn, there's a large spade-shaped bony growth, with peculiar phalanges extending up in front of the eye so that he can see only straight up. This probably accounts for the deliberate disposition of the animal, which wanders through the spruce woods looking for suitable food. About the only living creature which the Hodag can catch is the porcupine. Indeed, it would appear that the porcupine is its natural food. Upon sighting one rolled up in the branches of a spruce, the Hodag begins to blink his eyes, lick his chops, and spade around the tree, cutting all the roots until the tree begins to totter. He then backs off, and with a rush, rams his shovel nose under the roots and overgoes the tree, knocking the breath out of the porcupine in its fall. The Hodag then straddles the fallen tree, follows it out to the top, where the huge pointed hoofs of its front feet crush the helpless porcupine, and then deliberately swallows him head first. In the autumn, the Hodag strips the bark off a number of spruce or pine trees and covers himself all over with pitch. He then searches out a patch of hardwood timber where dead leaves lie thick on the ground. Here, he rolls about until completely encased in a thick, warm mantle of leaves, in which condition he spends the winter.
The Hodag is a perfect example of the creature starting out somewhere and then going somewhere else. Like, for example, if you watched my Cryptid Iceberg series when I got to the Hodag, you'll know that the legend of it is much greater than that in the modern age. Like, now it's stories about how the creature lives deep within caves and smells of rot, and how it was born from the ashes of oxen that were worked to death in the timber woods, and now those spirits have come back as this compiled, snarling, angry creature looking for revenge. And you can do that with any of these stories. Any of them can be something greater than just what their pieces describe. And the Hodag is a testament to what can be done with just a basic starting point of how far a legend can go. And speaking of how far a legend can go, we have one of the most famous fearsome critters, the squonk.
The range of the squonk is very limited. Few people outside of Pennsylvania have ever heard of the quaint beast, which is said to be fairly common in the hemlock forest of that state. The squonk is of a very retiring disposition, generally traveling about at twilight and dusk. Because of its misfitting skin, which is covered with warts and moles, it is always unhappy. In fact, it is said by people who are best able to judge to be the most morbid of beasts. Hunters who are good at tracking are able to follow a squonk by its tear-stained trail, for the animal weeps constantly. When cornered and escape seems impossible, or when surprised and frightened, it may even dissolve itself in tears. Squonk hunters are most successful on frosty moonlit nights, when tears are shed slowly and the animal dislikes moving about. It may then be heard weeping under the boughs of dark hemlock trees. Mr. J.P. Wentling, formerly of Pennsylvania, but now at St. Anthony Park, Minnesota, had a disappointing experience with a squonk near Mont Alto. He made a clever capture by mimicking the squonk and inducing it to hop into a sack, in which he was carrying it home, when suddenly, the bird enlightened and the weeping ceased. Wentling unslung the sack and looked in. There was nothing but tears and bubbles.
The squonk's adorable. I love him. You love him. Everyone loves him. A creature that is so ugly, it does nothing but cry all the time and will eventually dissolve into a puddle of tears. Much of you are the same. That was kind of mean, but you're also sitting here listening to some guy on the internet talk for 3 hours about campfire stories, so I'm just saying. Jokes aside, I think the squonk is so famous just because of how unique the creature is. Again, most stuff just wants to kill you, but it seems that the squonk is far more afraid of you than you are of it. Now, as far as something that you absolutely have to be afraid of, we have the whirling wimpus.
Occasionally, it happens that inexperienced hunters and others wandering in the woods disappear completely. Guides are unable to locate them, and all kinds of theories are offered to explain the disappearances. From the hardwood forest of the Cumberland Mountains, Tennessee, comes the rumor of an animal called the whirling wimpus, the existence of which may throw some light upon the fate of those who fail to come back to camp. According to woodsmen who have been looking timber in eastern Tennessee, the wimpus is a bloodthirsty creature of no mean proportions. It has a gorilla-shaped head and body and enormous front feet. Its unique method of obtaining food is to station itself upon a trail, generally at a bend in the trail, where it stands on its diminutive hind legs and whirls. The speed is increased until the animal is invisible, and the motion produces a strange droning sound, seeming to come from the trees overhead. Any creature coming along the trail and not recognizing the sound is almost certain to walk into the danger zone and become instantly deposited in the form of syrup or varnish upon the huge paws of the wimpus.
This thing is just like a creature with these giant claws that spin so fast, if you get close, you're immediately turned to red mist. As a matter of fact, in Treon's account of the creature, it spins so fast that you can't see it. All that you can do is hear a slight humming noise and maybe see a few leaves getting blown a little too fast around the area. But if you just so happen to step where it is, because again, it's moving so fast it's invisible to the human eye, you just die instantaneously. Talk about a way to terrify someone who's not familiar with the woods. You can just randomly walk into the spinning claw thing at a point and you can never hope to see it, so you better listen to a low humming or else you are super dead. Speaking of things that just kill you for doing nothing out of the usual, we have the agropelter.
Leading a vengeful existence, resenting the intrusion of the logger, the agropelter deals misery to the lumberjack from Maine to Oregon. Ill fares the man who attempts to pass a hollow tree in which one of these creatures has taken up its temporary abode. The unfortunate is usually found smashed or pinned by a dead branch and reported as having been killed by a falling limb. So unerring is the aim of the agropelter that despite diligent search, I have been unable to locate more than one man who has been the target for one of their missiles and yet survived to describe the beast. This is Big Ol' Kittleson, who, upon a certain occasion, when cruising timber on the upper St. Croix, was knocked down by a partly rotten limb thrown by an agropelter. This limb was so punky that it shattered on Ol's head, and he had time to observe the rascally beast before it bounded from the tree and whisked itself off through the woods. According to Ohl, the animal has a slender, wiry body, the villainous face of an ape, and arms like muscular whiplashes, with which it can snap off dead branches and hurl them through the air like shells from a 6-inch gun. It is supposed to feed upon hoot owls and woodpeckers, the scarcity of which will always prevent the agro pelter from becoming numerous in any locality.
It is a monkey that is sitting in the top of a tree and it hurls branches at you so hard it's like a gunshot. You just die. The only reason this guy survived one is because the branch was rotten enough that it blew up on his head instead of blowing his head up. So yeah, you can just be walking through the woods and get hit by a small log traveling 90 miles an hour. These are classic stories to scare people who aren't familiar with the Timberlands. And as another example of that, and one that I find to be one of the most humorous, we have the Splinter Cat.
A widely distributed and frightfully destructive animal is the Splinter Cat. It is found from the Great Lakes to the Gulf and eastward to the Atlantic Ocean, but in the Rocky Mountains has been reported from only a few localities. Apparently, the Splinter Cat inhabits that part of the country in which wild bees and raccoons abound. These are its natural food, and the animal puts in every dark and stormy night, shattering trees in search of coons or honey. It doesn't use any judgment in selecting coon trees or bee trees, but just smashes one tree after another until a hollow one containing food is found. The method used by this animal in its destructive work is simple, but effective. It climbs one tree, and from the uppermost branches, bounds down and across towards the tree it wishes to destroy. Striking squarely with its hard face, the Splinter Cat passes right on, leaving the tree broken and shattered as though struck by lightning or snapped off by the wind. Appalling destruction has been wrought by this animal in the Gulf states, where its work in the shape of a wrecked forest is often ascribed to windstorms.
The Splinter Cat cracks me up because could you just imagine being like an owl or a raccoon just chilling in a tree and then a cat flies through at the speed of sound and just blows the tree up? Like, yeah, there's no tactical precedence for that. There's no way to prepare for that happening. It just sucks. Also, that would be hilarious to watch too. You're just walking through the woods and then just a missile flies by and into a tree. But it also, again, like a lot of these other fearsome critters, is an explanation for something. Because when you see these random trees that are blown in half, sure, it's probably effective wind blowing over the top half and then maybe the part that was knocked off rotting away, or maybe the effect of lightning or something similar, but it's a lot more fun to imagine that it was the giant bowling ball cat. Now, moving back to the incredibly terrifying, we've got the snow wasset.
On the most northern logging camps of Canada, we hear of the snow wasset. This is surely an animal of the boreal zone. It is a migratory animal, wintering in the lumbering region between the Great Lakes and Hudson Bay, and spending its summers far north in Labrador and the Barren Grounds. Unlike most wild creatures of the north, the wasset is said to hibernate during only the warmest weather, when its hair turns green and it curls up in a cranberry marsh. During the summer, it has rudimentary legs, which enable it to creep slowly around and remain in the shade. After the first howling snowstorm, the wasset sheds its legs and starts south, dipping about in the snow. It soon attains remarkable skill in this method of travel, which enables it to surprise burrowing grouse, crouching rabbits, and skulking varmints of many kinds. Later in the winter, when food becomes scarce and more difficult to obtain, even wolves are seized from below and dragged howling and kicking into the snowdrifts. According to woodsmen, the tragedies of the far north are more numerous beneath the crusted snow than above it. There's no telling how many creatures are pulled down and eaten by the wasset, for this animal has a voracious appetite, comparable only to that of the wolverine. But since it is 4 times as big and 40 times as active as the wolverine, it must eat correspondingly more. The only specimen of this beast ever examined by white men was an imperfect one at James Bay, where a party of surveyors found an Indian in a peculiar canoe, which, upon examination, was shown to be made from one wasset hide greatly stretched. There being no leg holes in the white winter pelt, it is peculiarly adapted to the making of shapely one-man canoes, which are said to be used also as sleds by the Indians. A whole battery of deadfalls are believed to be used in trapping a wasset, since it is impossible to tell in what direction the animal's body may extend. The trigger is set so that a dozen logs fall in from all sides towards the bait, pinning the animal under the snow, wherever he may be.
Like, with things like the agropelter, you could maybe look to the top of a tree and see it and get some hint that it could be there. But the snow wasset is kind of in the same vein as the whirling wimpus, in that there's just no way to prepare. If it's snowing outside, cool, there could be a giant polar bear-faced snake thing that will drag you under the snow and kill you, and you just have nothing you can do. It's not hard, again with creatures like this, to see how it became the stuff of scary stories. And now for a just very weird one, we have the Central American Wind Tosser.
In the spring of 1906, there appeared suddenly in the coast ranges of California an uncanny animal from the region of the Isthmus. It is not a large beast, but what it lacks in size, it makes up in meanness of disposition. None of the lumberjacks who have met a wind tosser on trail or tote road care to have the experience repeated. Central American wind tosser is always looking for trouble or making it. In fact, the beast seems to be constructed for the purpose of passing through unusual experiences. Its head is fastened to its body by a swivel neck, so is its short, tapering tail. And both can be spun around at the rate of 100 revolutions a minute. The body is long and triangular, with three complete sets of legs. This is a great convenience in an earthquake country, since the animal is not disturbed by any convulsions of the earth. If the floor suddenly becomes the ceiling, it does not matter, for the wind tosser is always there with the legs. Its hair is bristly, and all slants forward at sharp angle. It has been found that a cat's nine lives are as nothing to the one possessed by a wind tosser. This animal may be shot, clubbed, or strung on a pike pole without stopping the wriggling, whirling motions, or screams of rage. The only successful way of killing the beast is to poke it into a flume pipe so that all its feet strike the surface, when it immediately starts to walk in three different directions at once and tears itself apart. John Gray of Anadar, Trinity County, California, knows where a pair of wind tossers live in some broken up country along Mad River.
So this thing is basically a log-shaped creature that can walk on three different sides, and there's really no way to kill it unless you put it in a tube, and then all the sides will get scared and walk away from each other, ripping itself apart. I mean, I can only imagine all the stories that were made up. Some old hunter's tale talking about how he's taken down his share of bear or deer, but it was the wind tosser that was his greatest foe. And then he talks about how maybe he trapped it in a log and the creature ripped itself apart or something like that. It's so easy to see where the legends come from. Also, that's just a really funny and weird thing to imagine, so I like it. Now for a more whimsical one, we have the Bildad.
If you've ever paddled around Boundary Pond in northwest Maine, at night you've probably heard from out the black depths of a cove a spat like a paddle striking the water. It may have been a paddle, but the chances are 10 to 1 that it was a Bildad fishing. This animal occurs only on this one pond in Hurricane Township. It is about the size of a beaver, but has long, kangaroo-like hind legs, short front legs, webbed feet, and a heavy, hawk-like bill. Its mode of fishing is to crouch on a grassy point overlooking the water, and when a trout rises for a bug, to leap with amazing swiftness just past the fish, bringing its heavy, flat tail down with a resounding smack over him. This stuns the fish, which is immediately picked up and eaten by the Bildad. It has been reported that 60 yards is an average jump for an adult male. Up to 3 years ago, the opinion was current among lumberjacks that the Bildad was fine eating. But since the beasts are exceedingly shy and are hard to catch, no one was able to remember having tasted the meat. That fall, one was killed on Boundary Pond and brought into the Great Northern Paper Company's camp on Hurricane Lake, where the cook made a most savory slum gullin of it. The first and only man to taste it was Bill Murphy, a tote road swamper from Ambigedges. After the first mouthful, his body stiffened, his eyes glazed, and his hands clutched the table edge. With a wild yell, he rushed out of the cockhouse, down to the lake, and leaped clear out 50 yards, coming down in a sitting posture, exactly like a Bill Dad catching a fish. Of course, he sank like a stone. Since then, not a lumberjack in Maine will touch Bill Dad meat, not even with a pike pole.
So the Bill Dad starts out as, like, you know, a basic kind of mythical creature design. But then it gets the fun tone of, if you eat it, you basically do the same thing it did. You also, like a kangaroo, begin hopping across the water, and you can't help yourself. And this guy who ate one just took off into the night. And keeping with the theme of whimsy, we have the Tripodero.
The chaparral and foothill forests of California contain many queer freaks, one kind and another. One of the strangest and least known is the Tripodero, an animal with two contractile or telescopic legs and a tail like a kangaroo's. This peculiarity in structure enables the animal to elevate itself at will so that it may tower over the chaparral or, if it chooses, pull in its legs and present a compact form for crowding through the brush. The Tripodero's body is not large but is solidly built, and its head is nearly all snout, the value of which is seen in the method by which food is obtained. As the animal travels through the brush-covered country, it elongates its legs from time to time, thus shoving itself up above the brush for purposes of observation. If it sights game within a range of 10 rods, it takes aim with its snout and tilts itself until the right elevation is obtained. Then, with astonishing force, blows a sun-dried quid of clay, knocking its victim senseless. A supply of these quids is always carried in the left jaw. The Tripodero then contracts its legs and bores its way through the brush to its victim, where it stays until the last bone is cracked and eaten.
The Tripodero is effectively a living tripod, effectively shooting any prey it finds in the brush and then lowering itself down again like a tripod to eat it. It's plain to see where these kind of stories could come from. Someone leaves a tripod out in the field and you convince the kid in your group that it's a Tripodero and you better not get close or it's going to shoot him with clay. Another thing that could equally be as dangerous, even though it's not so much in its stories, is the Hyumpum hog bear.
Ranging from mouth of the Columbia River southward to the Klamath, woodsmen report the existence of a bear known as the Hyumpum hog bear. This is a small, sharp-nosed, curly-haired variety of the black and brown bear of the coast ranges, but must not be confused with the peak-teal cinnamon. To appreciate the importance of this animal, one must remember that hog ranches are common in northwestern California. The country there is peculiarly adapted to hog raising, and the industry would be attractive and highly profitable were it not for the existence of the hog bear. The mountain slopes are covered with scrubby and creeping oaks, which bear prodigious crops of sweet and very nutritious acorns. These naturally ripen earliest upon the lower slopes, where the young hogs begin to feed. As the acorns higher up the slopes begin to ripen, the hogs ascend the mountain, each week finding them a few hundred feet higher and many pounds fatter. About Christmas time, the last of the acorns are reached on the upper slopes, and the hogs have by that time become so fat that their legs scarcely reach the ground. The slightest jar is all that the hog bear gets in his destructive work. He mooches along the base of the mountain before the rancher has time to rustle his pork, and finding hogs so plentiful and so helplessly fat, he takes just one bite out of the back of each, leaving the porker squealing with agony and the rancher swearing with rage. While examining timber on a tributary of the Klamath River, California, Mr. Eugene S. Bruce of the Forest Services captured a cub hog bear, she presented to the National Zoo in Washington. Its development will be watched with interest and its disposition studied by members of the Biological Survey.
So the hog bear is weird. It doesn't explicitly say it like kills you or whatever. It just takes a single bite out of every pig in the field, which makes me wonder, was there like an epidemic of pigs having like a bite cut out of them? I guess maybe wolves would do that or something, but you think they'd eat the rest of it, not one individual bite from every one. I wonder if this was to explain a problem or if it was just a tall tale. It makes me ask a lot of questions, which I guess is good. You know, it's what the stories are supposed to do, but it's just a really weird detail. I mean, all these are weird details, but you get the point. So everything we've covered so far has been stuff from Cox's original work. So now we're moving on to a lot of the stuff Treon covered. And again, a lot of this is more narrative. There's like folklore elements added. Not as much as stuff like Yarn of the Big Woods, where it's exclusively stories. But there, it's more anecdotal, a lot of the stuff within this one. For an example of that, look at the Axe Handle Hound.
The bane of Supply and Depot Camp's northern logging operations has a head shaped like Peavey Axe. The body is slender and axe handle shaped, with short, stumpy legs. Looks a good deal like a dachshund, but really bears a closer resemblance to B.B. Bickford's Bureau Dog. Distinctly a nocturnal prowler, frequents the camps after nightfall, hunting for axe and peavey handles, of which it is voracious fond. One hound has been known to consume 2 boxes of DB handles and 16 6-foot peavey stalks in one night's eating. They make nice pets, but are costly to feed. Jim Peters once tamed one. That was short-sighted, because Jim had a wooden leg made from an axe helve. The only way he could keep his leg whole was to wear it to bed. But he got rid of the pup by feeding it red oak handles, which it dislikes as heartily as any experienced chopper.
For one, the detail that he had a leg made out of an axe handle and the dog kept trying to eat it is funny. But the Axe Handle Hound is also just, like, kind of cute. It's a dog that's like a dachshund, and it just likes to eat axe handles, and that's pretty much it. There are numerous stories of people using this to prank their friends. For example, someone leaves their axe out, just take the shaft off of it and leave the axe head, and then be like, ah, must have been that hound. Again, a lot of the fearsome critters aren't that fearsome. It's just kind of the name used to describe them altogether. But the Axe Handle Hound is actually a friend of man, which is pretty neat. Now, for another kind of household critter that is definitely not a friend of man, we have the Bald-tailed Cat.
In the early days, this feline undoubtedly enjoyed a much wilder circulation than at present. Recent surveys indicate that it is now pretty well confined to Harney County, Oregon, and Sullivan County, Pennsylvania. A fair-sized animal of about the dimensions of a wildcat, but with a far more aggressive disposition. Its chief physical characteristic is a hard, heavy, bony ball on the end of its tail. The feet are clawed, as with all true cats, making it an excellent climber. And the species has the stealthy habit of lying out on a limb, and when the unsuspecting lumberjack passes beneath, the cat drops on its victim and pounds him to death with the ball. In the rutting season, the male uses this instrument to call the female by drumming on a hollow log. This species has occasioned much discussion and peppery argument. It has often been confused with both the silver cat and the dingmall. A careful study of the equipment and habits of the three species shows plainly that they are by no means the same. It is quite possible that they are all distantly related. Perhaps the bald-tailed boy is a less highly developed variant of the same phylum.
For some reason, there's a lot of these, like cat or like mountain lion looking things that have a bald tail at the end, and we're going to get to some more of them in a minute. But they're at, like, varying different degrees of danger. Like, some of them don't do anything, and some of them just, like, eat people. I do think it's interesting, though, how there's, like, the bald-tailed cat, and then the dingmall, and the sliver cat, and they're all very similar, but they all have different attributes, and what that sounds like to me is an oral tradition that broke into different branches. Like, for example, maybe the story of it started somewhere in, like, central North America, right? But then maybe the Western lumberjacks developed the story into what became the sliver cat, and then the Eastern ones developed it into the dingmall, or vice versa. It seems like it started at one place and then changed, and because you can kind of use stories to track history and culture and the way information moves, I think it's fascinating. For another one that's equally fascinating, if a bit more insane, we have the Columbia River sand squink.
Of limited distribution, but possessing most unusual characteristics, reported to date only by prospectors, hunters, and sheep herders in the remote mountains of Washington, built somewhat on the lines of a coyote, somewhat on the pattern of a bobcat, but with ears like a jackrabbit. The tail is long and bushy, and is carried recurved along the back, the same as a squirrel's. A night prowler emerges after dark and sinks down to the river to fish. The squink isn't particularly fussy about its diet, but has a great fondness for electric eels, probably on account of their higher pH content. When hungry, it is a timid animal, but its courage returns after feeding, and it will then stalk boldly along the mountain trails until it sights a prospector returning from town. Thereupon, the squink will precede its victim by two or three rods, slowly waving its long tail and touching one ear and then the other. The previous few miles of travel on a heavy feed of electric eels generates a substantial charge of static, and these alternating contacts produce a series of brilliant discharges which invariably please and attract the traveler, who follows and is never seen again. Several nests of this animal have been located and carefully examined. They were all lined with portions of old inner tubes, while the eggs, for the squink is oviparous, were shelled with bakelite.
Okay, so I just want to know with this one, I have some questions. Like, was this used to explain away something? Because in a lot of folklore, there's stuff about ghost lights, or like the Brown Mountain lights that I made a video about, right? So there were already stories of lights floating. So was this a way to explain that? Or was this just completely made up and someone thought it'd be funny to add the part about it, you know, having like static electricity? Because the creature's insane. It's like a half rabbit, half squirrel, half mountain lion thing that eats electric eels and then because of that becomes electricity. And then when people follow it at night, they get killed by it, supposedly. Like, that's so wild. I just want to know if it was used to explain something or entirely made up. Either way, I like it, but it's just like a giant electric cat rabbit thing. That's fun. I know a lot of these are just me being like, oh, that's cool, I like it, and then describing it. Yeah, I can't help myself. I just thought this stuff was cool and wanted to share it with you. So, fight me, I guess. For another cool one that is incredibly short, we have the Kamada body.
Reported by Mr. B.B. Bickford of Gorham, New Hampshire, not found outside the White Mountains, a short, stubby, rather small animal resembling a woodchuck but having very soft, velvety, kitten-like fur. Harmless, but surprising, has the terrifying habit of suddenly rushing directly at you from the brush, then stopping only a few inches away and spitting like a cat. A strong mink-like scent is thrown, and the Kamada body rushes away.
For one, I love the name. It is a thing that comes at a body, so they call it the Kamada body. Also, it's just like, it's just a woodchuck that runs at you and spits at you. Like, it doesn't do anything else. It's so funny. Like, what probably happened is someone got scared by a woodchuck, and from there, the legend just grew. People were joking about it later. It's like, oh, I bet it wasn't a woodchuck. I bet it was a Kamada body or whatever. And then that just became a story that got recorded here, and now I'm telling you. It's funny how, like, legends can do that. It can just be from a small, like, corner of culture, or even just a thing that happened once, and then can result its way into 100 years of history, to now being told to however many people are listening to the video at this point. I don't know, it's just fascinating the way stories work. It's fascinating the way they stay alive. For another example of the whole bald-tailed cat thing I was talking about earlier, we have the Ding Mall.
Well known the White Mountains. In fact, above timberline in the call between Mount Adams and Mount Jefferson of the Presidential Range, there's a conspicuous, flat-topped boulder which, for many years, has been Ding Mall Rock. Conclusive, exhaustive researches have clearly proven the existence of two distinct varieties. The Northeastern, both varieties are cat-like, being long, slim, slick, sorry-looking gentlemen, having wolf-like pelts. Their bodies are long with short, powerful legs. As Irving Cobb has put it, he's built low to the ground like a carpet sweeper. The head is round, sessile, feline, with tufted ears and glowing eyes. Neither variety is harmful, but both possess a curious, inquiring nature. They are fond of lying out and open, sunny spots, top of Ding Mall Rock, for example, carefully scrutinizing what goes on in the valley below. The tail is very long, frequently twice the length of the body, but the California variety carries a medium-sized bony ball on the end thereof. This is used to keep off flies, to pound on dead trees to produce supply of soft silvers for lining the nest, and, in the mating season, to beat on the male's chest to call his mate. The female also wears a ball a shade bigger than the male's, but she only uses it to beat him with when he gets too obstreperous. Ranger Bill Gott once watched one of the California variety galloping along the crest of the Siskiyous, with the ball lashing from side to side and striking the trees with tremendous force. That, commented Ranger Bill, is the biggest kindling cat I ever saw. The cry of the eastern species is a dreadful, horrendous wail, while the call of the western variety sharply resembles the toot of a logging donkey. Females of both species invariably whelp on the top of a large, exposed rock.
See, it's very similar to the cat talked about earlier, but this one is expressly more friendly. It doesn't, like, you know, attack people or things and eat them. It uses its tail to hit trees to build a nest, and then the females use it to hit the man over the head when he becomes too annoying. It's like a peaceful version of the other story rendition that was more violent. And again, I think this is the same story, at least initially, that has branched out into something greater. Or maybe it's all part of the same story. Maybe one region can talk about how the ones here are peaceful while the ones on the other side of the country are more violent, or vice versa. It gives credence to the tale by making it something bigger than just a thing that happened once. Now, while on the topic of things that are terrifying and just kill you, we have the Dungavin Hooter.
Formerly quite common from Maine to Michigan, today only occasionally met with on the upper peninsula of the latter state. A marsh dweller, dangerous to human beings, shaped a good deal like an alligator, but curious as to equipment in that he has no mouth. The nostrils are abnormally large, the legs short, and the tail thick and powerful. The only cry is a loud snort. Concealing itself with satanic cunning behind a whiffle bush, the Dungavin Hooter awaits the passing logger. Oncoming within reach of the dreadful tail, the victim is knocked senseless and then pounded steadily until he becomes entirely gaseous, whereat he is greedily inhaled through the wide nostrils. Rum sought in prey is sought with a special eagerness.
This one's really funny. It's like a snoutless crocodile that churns you into powder and then snorts you. Which, again, it's very funny because it is a creature that is terrifying, right? Like, no one wants to be churned up into powder and then snorted, I hope. But also, it's, like, absurd, just the fact that something like this might exist. But because it has some, like, alligator characteristics, someone who's not that familiar with how nature works or science or something like that could be convinced into this thing existing. Again, especially if it's coming from seasoned veterans. Also, the mention at the end that if you're drunk, it especially wants you is hilarious, because I imagine the story works much better while inebriated. Speaking of drunken stories, we have the Philomaloo bird.
A curious character, varying widely from the unusual run of feathered animals, a bird distinctly low in intellectual curiosity, showing complete and consistent indifference as to where he's going. He prefers only to see where he's been, hence, he always flies backwards. A rather rare species, frequently heard of, but seldom seen. Authentic reports are none too common. This is odd for a turkey-like head on a long, bottle-green neck, sparsely spangled with large, silvery scales, a black right wing, and a pink left one make a color combination hard to miss. The nest is usually built upside down. The eggs, 7 to a clutch, are invariably grade D. The call resembles the clank of a Johnson bar being shoved into reverse. Variously called the goofus bird, the flue fly bird, etc.
The Philomaloo bird's interesting because there is a chance this came from a true sighting. There are some species of things like stork or crane that can temporarily glide backwards for a moment. So maybe someone witnessed that and then the story came from it. Obviously, stuff like the nest is built upside down, it looks like a turkey, those were added on later, but it could have had an inception that was real. Which leads to the question, how many of these other ones might have had inceptions that are real? Like, the Kamata body is just a woodchuck running up to someone. That's believable. But what about some of the other ones? What if maybe the boulder cat, or whichever the first cat with the boulder on its tail was, maybe someone was attacked by a mountain lion that had a weird growth on the end of its tail, and then the legend started there. How many of them came from something and then were made into something bigger? Now, as far as ones that are absolutely insane, in every regard, we have the Gumbaroo.
An uncommon, but nevertheless well-known, and thoroughly authenticated animal. Paul Bunyan often met them in the upside-down country. His description, given to me personally, was as follows. A pot-bellied body, almost exactly like the bunkhouse stove, even to the umbilical damper, and covered with very tight, tough, black, shiny skin. A pair of long, powerful, monkey-like forearms, and a little round head and no neck. His head sets right down on his shoulders like a hop toad in a cool spot. He's got three bowed rear legs, each with a clawed foot clutching an iron ball, the same as an iron stove. There's no speed in these rear legs, but they're handy for weighting dumps. For real travel, he's got 8 pairs of strong, springy legs set around his middle. He's plenty rapid on these. He'll go to a hilltop by swinging from branch to branch with his forelegs, then toss himself out a rod or two, landing sideways on the middle legs and rolling over and over down the hill, moving faster than the eye can see. That's why he's so rarely observed. The hides from the middle legs used to make fine waterproof boots, but they're pretty scarce now. The gumbaroo was usually found in burnt lands. Practically an indestructible animal, bullets always bounce from his taut hide, but heat would make him swell and explode. S.W. Allen photographed one, but the negative exploded.
This is one of the only ones we're talking about today that directly cross over into the Paul Bunyan mythos. For those who aren't familiar, Paul Bunyan is a figure within, I guess, American mythology, or more accurately, American folklore, that was effectively a giant lumberjack. There's stories about how he dragged his axe behind him that created the Grand Canyon, how he created waterfalls by, like, smacking his hand down on the ground, and a lot of these fearsome critters show up in his stories. And the gumbaroo, I think, is explicitly from one of his stories originally. Paul Bunyan, similar to a lot of these fearsome critters, would sit around, be talked at campfires, and then these entire stories would come out of it. Which would probably be a good idea to make a Paul Bunyan video one day. That seems up my alley. Well, Paul Bunyan's stories are usually happy and, like, have like, a good message or, like, ending to them. And I normally like it when stuff dies, but I can make an exception. I also like the idea that the gumbaroo is so explosive that if you take a picture of one, the picture will also explode. After that, we have one that is a personal favorite of mine, the hide behind.
A highly dangerous animal, but owing to its intense aversion to the odor of alcohol, never known to attack an inebriate. One bottle of Uno beer has been proven to be a complete safeguard, even in thickly infested country. A biggish beast, standing about 6 feet and walking erect. Slender body makes it possible to hide completely behind the bole of a 10-inch tree. The pelt is long, thick, and black, and the tail is carried recurved. Looks like a French sheepdog's. Almost impossible to tell whether the critter is going or coming, and practically hopeless to locate its face, if any. The short, well-muscled forelegs are equipped with grizzly-like claws. Its food is chiefly intestines. Leaping from its hiding place with a demoniacal laugh, it swiftly disembowels its victim with one swipe. Sometimes a fiendish howl frightens the prey to death before the blow falls. The hide behind is never found in the open. He always conceals himself behind a tree trunk. His marvelously quick, stealthy gait makes it possible for him to stay constantly behind his prey, no matter how quickly the suspicious victim may spin about in the hope of glimpsing the marauder. The beast can go 7 years without eating.
So the reason the hide behind is one of my favorites is, for one, I think it's pretty cool. The idea of a creature that no one even knows what it looks like. Sometimes you'll see depictions of them that kind of make them look like a wolf. Other times it's more humanoid. But no one knows what it looks like because anyone who's seen one's dead now. So it is just a thing that exists behind the trees. So that makes it easy for people to describe it however they want, because different areas can have their own different legends around it. And it also makes it something terrifying, because it is something that is always there, just out of view. It also has fun interactions with other monsters. Like, there's the mention that if you're drunk, then the hide behind doesn't want you. It no longer considers you a prey animal. But also remember, if you're drunk, and you know the story of the Dungavin Hooter, well, now the resistance from one creature makes you susceptible to the other. But another reason that the hide behind's one of my favorites is because it was probably my first interaction with the fearsome critters. When I was a kid, my grandfather told me about the hide behind, although he had a different name for it, the turnaway. Because, as most people would do with these stories, my grandfather made the story longer. He said that the only reason a hide behind attacks somebody is because they try to look at it. Basically, the creature is terrified of being witnessed by a human, perhaps out of shame or fear, so if you go looking for it, it gets furious and attacks. So if you see one, the best thing to do is turn around, hence the name turn away. Turn away or turn around, I believe he called it both. But it adds another layer to the story. If you're ever walking through the woods and you see something out of the corner of your eye, something that looks like it darted behind a tree, it's best not to go looking. Because sure, hopefully the animal can get away, but if you're a little too good at trying to find it, well, looks like you won't be around to tell the tale. And that's what I love so much about these stories. They can start off as one little piece, and then they can become something that recontextualizes the way you look at the forest. To this day, if I'm walking through the woods and I see something out of the corner of my eye, I try not to look because it might be a turnaway. Now, do I truly believe in these creatures? Do I think they're real? Well, no, but that doesn't matter. The piece of the story is still in my head. It is still something I think about that makes the woods just a little bit bigger. So sometimes I won't go look, because sometimes I might as well let the story be real. And while this is just one example of where the hide behind can go, any of these creatures can take another step like that. Any can become something that is a story in your head, something that sticks with you long after you've read it. And for another story that probably terrified a lot of people who heard it, we have the hoop snake.
A well-known menace. Its existence is thoroughly established by numerous reports from highly credible parties. The characteristics appear to be about the same in all regions. Its habit of tucking its tail in its mouth and rolling at incredible speed in pursuit of its prey or a fancied enemy is not duplicated, fortunately, by any other member of the animal kingdom. The tail ends in a stinger carrying venom of such power that a dose of but 0.003 parts per million is sufficient to make even the leather-skinned hodag turn green and swell up and die inside of an hour. No wonder that folks wise in woods lore are wary of this circular engine of destruction. He may travel on just one cylinder, but that's all he needs. The speed reached in rolling is nothing short of remarkable. A full-grown jackrabbit is pie for this snake. A mature snake, when hooped, has a diameter of 1.5923 feet. He has been clocked after being enticed onto a cleverly designed rolling meter platform at an RPM of about 1,056, or a straightaway speed of some 60 miles per hour. The only way to outrun him is to climb over a fence. The snake must unhoop to get through. There are many authentic cases of death from this reptile's venom. Possibly the most convincing bit of data is that, in a fit of pique, a hoop snake stung one of Paul Bunyan's peavey handles. Of course, his handle was a sizable stick to start with, but the venom swelled it to such dimensions that Paul cut it up into 946 cords of wood. And then the dang stuff wouldn't burn. Just lay in the stove and hissed.
The hoop snake is certainly one of the more popular ones that came out of the Fearsome Critters. I've heard this referenced in like westerns and stuff like that. And just the idea of a snake rolling at you at that speed is terrible. Especially considering it's described as so venomous it could take down even other fearsome critters with a single bite. I can imagine people hearing this story and being too afraid to leave the fence line just so they can jump over really quick if they see a hoop snake coming. And once again, we have a mention where the creature tied into Paul Bunyan's lore, connecting all of the different stories that would be passed around lumber camps across the entire United States into one sort of narrative. They don't all have to connect, they don't all have to make sense or perfectly fit into each other. They can be their own story one place and another story somewhere else. And again, another story that probably terrified a ton of people is the Lungerlang.
A dangerous fellow to meet up with, very likely to attack without any provocation. Bites but once a year, but the bite is sure death. Certain unique features make it easy, however, to identify the animal. A dark blue stripe down the spine, a bushy swivel-jointed tail set in the middle of the back, this appendage is most useful in keeping off the flies, and all four legs triple-jointed are what the traveler should look for. These legs make it possible for the Lungerlang to run equally fast in all directions. In case of an attack, the victim should suddenly hold a large mirror up beside himself. The double image will so confuse the beast that he will rush off in disgust. The biting season usually occurs on July the 12th. An orange-colored handkerchief conspicuously displayed will invariably afford full protection. Green clothing of any shade should be studiously avoided at this season, as it serves to arouse the animal further.
I don't know what it is, but the depiction in this book, I hate it. The way its eyes look, the way it's staring at the guy, terrifying. And again, it's fun because it's a creature that's never spotted, right? I mean, okay, these are all urban legends. None of them are spotted, but you know what I mean. Within the legend, the creature is never spotted. So it has this, like, super bright, ornate features that are so mysterious, just holding a mirror up to it turns the creature away. I also think it's so funny how the biting season is July 12th. not the summer or even just July. It is the 12th of July. So imagine, how terrified, because if they only attack once a year, they're probably going to attack that day. Imagine how terrified, like, some kid would be in the week leading up to July 12th. He's carrying a mirror everywhere, and I'm sure everyone else laughed at him for that. But to him, the story's very real. I mean, these guys who know better told him about it. So on July 12th, you better believe he has a full-size mirror, and that's a funny detail that he can't even carry a small one. It is a full-size mirror he has to carry around camp. Or even the smaller stuff, like the orange-colored handkerchief. Like, if on July the 12th you see a bunch of people wearing orange handkerchiefs, then they probably fell for the joke. I like the specificness of creatures like this. You can see where the story became a gag. And because it makes it so much real in people's minds, I think it's all the better for it. And talking about stories that caution you from something, we have the Rumtificel.
In luring a victim within its reach, this animal employs one of the oldest strategic devices known. That of playing on the cupidity of its prey. Being a rather slow-gaited beast, it has to resort to some form of low cunning. The Rumtificel is large, strong, and ferocious. The pelt is fine, long, and thick, with a rich color like a mink. The body is oddly flattened, somewhat the way old Hank McGinnis looked after he rolled off the porch roof following the annual fireman's dinner. And sort of spread himself out so flat, we just slid him edgeways between a couple of shed doors for a coffin. This shape makes it possible for the Rumtificel to drape himself closely over a stump or about the butt of a tree standing near a tote road, in such adroit fashion that he looks exactly like a high-grade fur coat or robe that someone has dropped. Naturally, a passerby comes over to have a closer look. With a lightning-fast flick of its blanket-like body, the Rumtificel completely envelops its victim. The numerous minute sucking pores lining the inner ventral surface are promptly brought into action, and in no time at all, the bones are sucked clean. Some of these high ginger scientists will tell you that those little balls of fur you often see beside an old stump were spit up by owls. Don't you go and swallow that yarn. Those balls are all that's left of the clothes worn by some greenhorn ventured too near.
This one's fun because I'm sure there were a ton of times that someone saw a coat or a piece of cloth lying along the side of a trail. And again, what once becomes someone dropping something off of a wagon or leaving their jacket behind now becomes a whole legend. Or alternatively, you tell the story around camp if you don't want anyone touching your jacket. Also, just the idea of like a living blanket thing that eats people's cool, it kind of reminds me of the El Quiero from Central and South American cryptid beliefs of like this piece of cloth that looks like a piece of clothing and then kills you. So there's some fun crossover there. Maybe one story inspired the other, but it's also just fun, again, with something to terrify people who see a jacket on the ground. After that, we have the Santer.
One of the few marauding varmints reported below the Mason and Dixon line, common in western North Carolina, rarely dangerous to mankind, but a frequent predator on livestock. His body is long, covered with reddish long hair. His head is large, round, and bald. His legs and feet are long, and his eyes are small with a mean look. His tail is almost as long as his body, and has 8 hard knots in it. Looks like a string of beads. He can swing this flail with plenty of power and skill, enough to knock out a cow or a hog with one slap. And obviously, this tail can be effectively used in combat. But he can travel so fast, he seldom has to put up a scrap. Lives mostly in wooded swamps in the neighborhood of small villages where cattle and hogs are kept. A remarkably fast animal, but rarely seen, its cry is a piercing, baby-like wail. Dogs will seldom run one. A calf known to have been killed by one of these varmints near Statesville showed 8 distinct bruises, 7 on the body and 1 on the broken foreleg. The hair about each bruise was severely singed.
The Santer is interesting because it reminds me a lot of the way that, like, dragons would be described in old folklore, right? Like, it's a mysterious thing in the mountains, it's so fast you'll never see it, but it's like a mighty beast to be slain. I like the illustration of it too, it's mysterious. You only see the tail and the dog barking at it, you never see the beast. So if things near the Western Carolinas go missing, it may be the work of this Appalachian dragon. So the Santer's cool, I like it, but not as much as I like our next one, the Sidehill Gouger.
We've had a good bit of perceptibly acrimonious discussion as to the correct Vulgate name of this engaging little animal. Some Easterners say Sidehill Badger. Some Californians insist that Sidehill Winder is correct. There are some vigorous proponents of Godifro, Proc, and Sidehill Wowser, while a few technical parties claim that Gyascidus is the one and only. The majority of the pleadings are in favor of the Gouger, so we'll stand on that. Always a dweller in hilly country, he has to be, since his nigh legs are shorter than the off pair. There are 6 to 8 pups in a litter, and once in a great while, some of them arrive with the relationship reversed. After being weaned, these sports are rarely seen again by their orthodox-legged brothers and sisters. Normal gougers must, obviously, travel around the hillside, and in making their daily rounds for food, they wear the characteristic, partly gouged-out paths so familiar to woodsmen. These paths were once very common in New England, but today they are thought to be most frequently seen in the partly forested regions of the West. I am indebted to Mr. Bill Erickson of North Haven, Maine, and various other points, for the following account of how the gouger population migrated from New England. "It seems," said Bill, "that the gouger population was getting too thick. There weren't enough food to go around, and somebody just had to move out. A pair of these ambitious little varmints, one orthodox, one abnormal-legged, got together and decided to strike out for a new location. Of course, they could navigate on the hillsides and slopes all right, but they knew mighty well they'd bog down on the flats. So, when they struck level going, they just leaned against each other with the longer legs outermost. Sort of like a pair of drunks going home from town. This mighty smart adaptation of a natural deformity took them well across the central states and made it possible for them to found the gouger colonies now existing in the West."
Okay, this is everything I love about the fearsome critters. For one, it is an animal that is a little messed up. Its legs are longer on one side than the other, so that's kind of fun. But then it's everything that gets done with that legend that's so interesting. So if you've ever been walking on a hillside, you've probably seen, there's different names for them. I've always called them game trails. It's places where things like rabbits or deer will run through enough that it becomes kind of a little pathway. I've also heard them called like paths of desire. I've also heard runoff trails because water runoff will stop there, kind of waterfall down, and that's how they erode over time. There's a bunch of different names for them, but everyone who's been walking through the woods has seen this little trail along the ground that they've thought nothing of. Well, now the Sidehill Gouger gives an explanation for that. Because the animal's legs are bent a certain way, it can only walk around the hill a certain way, and over time, tramps out a path. It's a cool idea that if a child is born and its legs are the other orientation, the mom has to abandon it, because it's not like it can turn around. And they mention that the way they immigrated is one of one orientation and another of another orientation leaned against each other and just walked out to the plains. And then there's other stories that came about people like tying them together in order to get yard work, of rare variations that could switch the direction their head was pointing so that they could reverse along a mountainside. It explains stuff that is seen, it is mythical, it is special, it's like the lore for it has been thought out, even in an oral tradition told around campfires. It's so much fun. And you best believe, every time after I learned about it, that I've been in the mountains and seen a game trail, I tell someone about the Sidehill Gouger. And that's the coolest part about these stories. They keep living on because they're interesting enough to live on. Now, back to the terrifying stuff, we have the scariest rendition of a giant cat with a ball in its tail, the sliver cat.
A northern pine woods dweller, harmless on the ground, but dangerous when up in a tree. A big animal, sometimes reaching 300 pounds weight. Its ears are tasseled and its eyes red with horizontal slits. A mature sliver cat carries a tail 11 feet long with a hard ball on the end. Half of this ball is polished smooth, half is studded with a burr-like barbed growth. Like the dingmall, cat beats the ball on his chest in the mating season, being careful to use only the smooth side. But the chief function, or should it be secondary, of this tail is to obtain food. Crouched on a limb overhanging the trail, the cat pats the passerby on the head with the polished side of his ball, and then slaps the bird side into the senseless victim's hide, draws him up to the roost to be consumed. Sliver cat crouched on a limb with his ball tail poised for instant action makes a startling silhouette against the full moon.
The sliver cat, it's just mean. It just bonks people over the head and then eats them while hanging from the tree. That's awful. And again, as mentioned earlier with the Ding Mall and Boulder Cat, it seems like a rather harsh rendition of the same legend. And I like that. I like how we can track stories off of how they became. Maybe one region was suffering a more fatal season, and maybe the stories they told were more violent to match. Or vice versa, maybe the story was nicer because it gave them a reprieve from everything they experienced, and then the opposite happened on the other side of the country. It's interesting what can be learned about people and the folklore they would tell through just their stories. And if all of that is true, then anyone who is in a snow-covered region at all absolutely hated themselves, because similar to the giant polar bear snake thing earlier, we have the snow snake.
During the year of the two winters, when the July temperature dropped to negative 62 degrees, these pink-eyed, white-bodied savage serpents crossed over from Siberia via Bering Strait. They are bad actors. The venom is deadly, with a speed of action second only to that of the hood snake or the hamadryad. Hibernating in summer, but becoming active in winter, the snow snake coils on a low drift where its pure white color makes it wholly invisible to its prey. One strike is sufficient. Mankind is not often bitten, as he makes too big a mouthful. Sometimes the snake will get overambitious. When this does happen, Tanglefoot oil is the only known remedy. I was treated by a snow snake is still a much-used explanation of a late homecoming.
This one's just mean. Again, it's like there is a snake that is the color of snow that is under the snow, and if you get bit, you die. There is the kind of lighthearted mention there at the end that people say they got treed by a snow snake, which is funny. Like, you know, if you're late out hunting and, you know, the missus asks where you're at, you can just say, oh, well, you know, those snow snakes. But if anyone actually believed it, that's awful. That they could just be walking on the snow and then something the color of the snow kills them. But again, it is another new way to look at an area that the person's already familiar with. Speaking of stuff that's just terrifying, the swamp auger.
This boy, often mistaken for an old snag, is found in freshwater lakes. He carries a swiveled proboscis especially adapted to boring 3-inch holes in the bottoms of boats and will do so unless stopped. But his work can be easily halted, either by tickling his snout or by sprinkling it with cayenne pepper. Either procedure will make the auger sneeze violently, which he hugely enjoys, and he will then hold his expectant nose tight in the hole until the boat can be beached.
So the swamp auger is kind of funny in that, you know, if you feed it pepper, it goes away. But also imagine just being in a boat and then something comes and just drills a hole in the boat. That's mean. Also, the mention that the cayenne pepper makes it sneeze, but it loves sneezing so much that it can't help but stay there. It's kind of... All right. But again, that's what's fun about these stories. They're so creative. Like, I would never expect that out of a narrative anywhere else. But out of the American Mountain Men, I could see it. Next up, we have another one of the more famous fearsome critters, and one mentioned earlier, the tree squeak.
Some folks will claim that the mating call of the tree squeak is just a dry tree lodged in a school marm. But we old boys know better. The sound is made by an untrustworthy animal, still quite common in the North Woods. Built something like a weasel, and with the same nice, friendly disposition, he is a chameleon-like, and can wrap himself around a tree trunk and match the bark exactly. He is sometimes aggressive, but only after a long, dry spell. Has a variety of calls, whine like a panther, squeal like a young pig, sometimes a roar like a bunch of cannon crackers at a shotgun wedding. Look out for him on windy days, along towards sundown.
The tree squeak is fun. Anyone who's been in the hills can tell you that they have heard something that they cannot place the origin of. So you can say, oh, well, it's this little weasel-looking thing that can camouflage itself the color of trees and then wrap around them. Because there's no way to disprove that on its own existence, because it could be camouflaged literally anywhere in the woods. And we've already seen in the example I read earlier how this story would be implemented. Someone mentions they heard something scary, and then two people start to spin a yarn, trading details back and forth, that make it seem all but definite to the person who heard something that it might have been a tree squeak. Because it's easy to paint stories of things that there isn't evidence of. An example of that is the Wampus Cat.
Since the first specimen was discovered scratching false blazes on mount trails, the Wampus Cat has been blamed for a variety of forest tribulations. If a Wampus wades a stream, the fish won't bite for 7 days. When the Wampus is on the prowl, the only game abroad is the fool hen. The howl of the wampus on a lonely night will curdle a crock of sourdough. Females of the species may be killed only with a crosscut saw. The males, practically indestructible, carry in their fur the germ of blister rust. Under the influence of a full moon, the glare from their eyes starts forest fires. Their footprints are visible only in solid rock. They steal prospectors' picks to brush their teeth. Now the wampus, still abundant in its native Idaho, and particularly large and violent during the season when the crop of dudes yields a bushel to the picket line, has an opportunity to redeem itself. A favorite pastime of the feline is snatching eagles. Trappers on the Salmon River are plagued, they say, with eagles killing deer. The game department is angry with the eagles and seeking a solution to a vexing problem. Eagle lovers, their name has been Legion, are angry with the game department. The simple solution suggested by the Wampus Society, which is composed of every man who has seen a rampant wampus cat at dusk menacing a mountain lion with a jackhammer, is that the burden be turned over to the wampus breed. Once the wampus reaches the eagle country, the feathers will fly. Nature has endowed the marvelous cat with an amazing right forearm. It works like a folding pruning hook on the pantographic principle. The wampus lurks on a craggy promontory with its tufted ears a saint like the budding prongs of a young goat and its voice softened from the customary howl of a disenfranchised banshee to the bleat of a kid. When an eagle approaches, Strange Arm shoots out with astonishing speed and direction. The eagle is caught and reeled in.
So for one, the wampus cat kind of feels like a Looney Tunes character with all the hijinks it can get up to, and also, like, you know, the extendable arm or whatever. But also, there would be stories around it that made it make sense to the people who were in the area. For example, apparently, eagles used to be a problem. Well, now they're not. Oh, it's because of the wampus cat. There's also mention that the wampus cat is at peace with the native people of the land, and because of that, they don't hunt it. That's the reason you'll never see their fur for sale at any trade post. And you can see how all of these details would feed into the mind of someone who might believe these stories. That being said, I also just like the idea of, like, a comedically fictional cat grabbing eagles out of the air. That's hilarious. For another absurdly over-the-top story, we have the Whiffin' Poof.
A tasty fish, found only in perfectly round lakes, hence quite rare. To catch him, row to the exact center of the lake, using the hog yoke to determine position, and bore a square hole in the water. Bait the edge of this hole with a bit of cheese, preferably brie, Stilton, Liederkranz, or best of all, Limburger. Whiffin' Poof will quickly scent the bait and come for it. When he emerges, spit tobacco juice in his eye. This will make him so swell with rage that he won't be able to withdraw into the hole, and you can easily net him.
I can't help but imagine this came from a singular instance. Like, there was a guy and another guy sitting on the edge of a circle pond, and one of them was like, hey, if you go into the middle of that and you got cheese, and if you put the cheese over, this big fish will come up, but then you have to spit tobacco juice in its eye. And, it's called the Whiffin' Poof. Yeah. So good luck with that. Because, I mean, like, the details are way too explicit. It's too easy to see this being used to gag someone. There are a ton of stories like this, by the way, of just people using an individual thing to make someone else go hunting for it. One of the best examples outside of narratives was, like, taxidermied things that were used to convince people there was something to go catch or hunt. The most famous example is the jackalope, right? The rabbit with the deer antlers. People would take a taxidermied rabbit and then these small deer antlers and put them on the rabbit and then tell people that, oh yeah, out west you can go hunting for these. And there'd be so many stories that would arise about, like, well, they're rare because they can only breed during a lightning strike, like the micro instant of a lightning strike. There were states that sold permits to hunt them, but the permits were always on fictional dates, like the 31st of a month with only 30 days or something like that. So these stories would be bred off of just a taxidermy statue. Another example is the fur-bearing trout. Again, a trout that is wrapped in rabbit's fur, so people would be convinced that if they stay at the fishing hole just a little bit longer, they might be able to catch one. Stories like that, stories that were immediately used as like a hazing ritual on newcomers to the area, are a lot of fun. And speaking of stories that were used as hazing rituals, we have what is probably the most famous fearsome critter in the last one we're going to talk about today, the snipe.
A common bird, occasionally seen, but never yet caught, Legions of sharp-eyed young foresters, engineers, cruisers, cookies, rodmen, and hard rock apprentices have made repeated, careful, and valiant attempts to corral one, but notwithstanding the bushels of careful advice and instruction handed out by the older hands in the party, success has not yet been attained. Seldom does the seasoned woodsman make the attempt. He is probably too discouraged to try again, but he is often willing to travel along with the hunting party just to see what happens, or perhaps to offer an occasional word of advice. Many years ago, I was taken on a snipe hunt and was able to get a good look at one bird which strayed near the bag I was so carefully holding. I couldn't get my hands on the little fellow, but I did have time to study him a bit. And I find that my observations tally very closely with a detailed report received from Mr. Howard S. Gardner. Here's the summary. A bird of marvelous coloration, green, blues, pinks, and here and there the glint of gold. Wears both fur and feathers, with the fur side inside like Majekowee's. Stands erect with 17 centimeters high on two legs, but has a third auxiliary slightly aft, for use either as a stabilizer or as a starting mechanism. Lacking this additional leg, permanent unstable equilibrium would result. The eyes are fired with a constant sulfurous glow, occasionally emitting small showers of sparks. One pupil is vertical, one horizontal, and winking is done alternately, keeping the snipe constantly alert. The sharply hooked little beak is mounted on a bullwheel base like a steam shovel, making possible the capture of insects without turning the head. All in all, a most interesting and elusive animal. The fur and feathers combination makes the ideal protective coat for the natural marshy habitat. When the snipe is swimming, the rigid feathers fold back, forming a perfectly smooth outer surface, which reduces skin friction to a minimum. With the fur inside, the snipe possesses a waterproof, fur-lined overcoat.
So, I don't need to describe the snipe to you. You've all heard the phrase snipe hunt. Maybe some of you have even been on a snipe hunt. Different versions of the story have different characteristics. I remember when I was a kid, it was described as like it had stork legs. It was like 3 feet tall and golden or something. And that the meat on them was like super, super expensive. So if you caught one, you were rich. Like there's different variations of the story wherever you go. What I would like to mention is that I actually was a victim to a snipe hunt when I was younger. When I was like 10 or 11, there were some older guys that our family was hanging out with who told us about snipes and said that they found a couple in the backyard the night prior and they needed help catching them. So, I mean, I'm a child. I don't believe anything that I'm not told. So they hand me like a sack, I think like a potato sack, and a flashlight. And I was out there at midnight, like looking through the bushes. And then they started freaking out like, oh, one's in that bush, one's in that bush. So, like, me and a couple other kids, like, ran and jumped on the bush with the sack and, like, kept punching each other because I guess I thought I was under attack by a snipe. And then when we come out of the bush, the older kids are gone, and we were lost. We had to get back. At the time, I was terrified, but looking back, it was hilarious. But that's what these stories are. They're, like, they can be used for memories like that. They can be used for gags, these fleeting moments, because otherwise, that night of just, like, sure, it was a good time hanging out with, like, friends my age and stuff, but now it's become something that I'm telling you all about, something I'm going to tell my kids about. It is something that makes moments in life so much more, and that's why I love these stories. At the opening of Tryon's book, there's a dedication that says, to those who have held the bag on a snipe hunt, who have jumped sideways at the call of the tree squeak, who have studied the trail of the sidehill gouger, and who perhaps have had a ring-sized seat at a badger fight, this little collection is sympathetically dedicated. I guarantee you, if you watching talk to a grandparent, talk to a distant relative, talk to someone in the family or a friend who grew up in the mountains or of familiar with American folklore, they have some story like that of being tricked into a whirling wimpus being up the trail or hearing a story of a tree squeak like that lived near their property and wouldn't shut up at night. These stories make the woods, they make the people in them a little bit bigger. And I can't appreciate that enough. There are so many people that are simply lost to history, right? Like, the names of these lumberjacks who sat around the fire. Sure, we know a few of them. People like Cox or Tryon who put these stories together, or people who lived around the time. I'm not saying that they're completely forgotten, but a lot of them are. It was a lot more than these two men who swapped the stories around. A lot of them worked and lived a life, and then they died, and they're forgotten. But the stories they told are still here. I'm telling you about them right now, and in that sense, they're never really gone. At the beginning of Cox's book, there's another dedication he writes, or not a dedication, an introduction, about why he feels recording these stories are important, why he wants to list them down, and he ends on this paragraph. The lumber regions are contracting. Stretches of forest that once seemed boundless are all but gone. And many a stream is quiet that once ran full of logs and echoed of the song of the river driver. Some say that the old type of logger himself is becoming extinct. It is my purpose in this little book to preserve at least a description and sketch of some of the interesting animals which he has originated. Not only do I think these stories are fun, not only am I most definitely going to take my child on a snipe hunt one day, but also I feel like it's important to share. I feel like these were stories that meant something to someone, and who are we if we just let them die? So now I know about it, and now you know about it. Now you're stuck with it. You can't get rid of that information. You may forget it one day, but not on purpose. So you're welcome for that. So hopefully you found something interesting out of these stories. Hopefully you found some story to pass along or to keep someone up at night with, to scare them just a little bit more, and I think that's really cool. And you're really cool, and thank you for sticking around, and I just want to say thank you for watching. For real, thank you all so much for being here, for the support you've shown the channel. I know uploads have been a little lacking lately before the last scripted upload, because I was on tour, and then my wife and I were doing a lot of work at the house and stuff like that, so I wasn't that available to record videos, but I appreciate you all being there, for showing up for the upload afterwards regardless, for watching this one all the way to the end. It means a lot. So there will be more content on the way. Like I said at the beginning, we're getting into the spooky season, so I'm excited. Hopefully you are as well. As far as for the Fearsome Critters, like I said, there is a link to the lumberwoods.org website where you can read all of these online. Most of them are like pushing 100 years old at this point, so for the most part, they're like Creative Commons. You know, anyone can read them, publish them how they want. I will mention that these books are very old, like I said. So when the author talks about people of certain minority groups, they are less than nice in their description of it. And I've omitted a lot of that phrasing and stuff in this video. But if you are sensitive to that kind of thing, then your discretion as you go into it, of course. Thank you all so much for sticking around. Hopefully these stories can serve to your interest in the future, and that's really cool, and I appreciate it. And let me know in the comments if you've ever been scared by one of these or scared someone else with one of these, or if you have a similar snipe hunt story like I did when you were a kid, because those stories that we birth out of these pre-existing stories are stories in their own right. They're stuff that can carry on and go forward. So be sure to share those, because a story that you let die with you is of no use, right? So get those out there. Thank you all so much for watching the video as long as you have. Stay tuned for the Halloween season. Got a lot of cool stuff coming on here, on Creepcast, on the Red Thread. And you all have been a blessing supporting me all around. It means a lot. Thank you. But regardless, I believe that should be it. But before I go, I just want to say thank you for watching. I hope that you enjoyed. And I will see you in the next one. Bye!